And then he was more playful about, he had completed it. He was emphasizing technological determinism in the 40s because it was something he knew no one else was talking about. But then once television came in, I think he didn't mind appearing technological determinist because he wasn't that anymore. He had figured out tactile interplay or something. Or he'd figured out that that the miniaturization that television was beginning to bring in was going to free people up from being massaged and being technologically determined. Now, it's hard to say because people look more robotic, you know, since television. But that's because they're becoming another form. They're actually becoming digital. In the analog phase, remember, Thomas Aquinas, when one form is dominant, another form is surfacing.
Yeah.
I think that's the autonomy McLuhan saw, that media converging, shrinking, and that was going to make technology friendlier, at least in a later phase, in the digital phase. And so he would stop making technological determinism his point. He was actually making autonomy his point. So he didn't mind that it was seen as technological determinism because he knew he had more to say about that than they expected. Let them be a technological determinist, and then when in debate or discussion, or whenever he had to perform publicly, he would bring in another meaning for that. That'd be a way of pulling the rug out of those who were unconscious technological determinists in the hot period, then became conscious of it, complained about it, and were comprehensive about technological determinism, and McLuhan was there to make it a fuller vision. Anyways, that's very skirting eschatological levels there. I don't mean.
No, I'll have to go and ponder that pattern, Bob. I can't respond to that immediately, but
Talked about before. McLuhan is acting; he's not what he appears to be writing, and he's distracting people, and he's ready to come up with another angle.
Yeah, there's another just a passing digression that that sort of almost needs mention. Like always, in the biographies, it comes off that McLuhan devoured modern detective fiction, right?
Yeah,
and it's often put across that he loved them and this, that, and the other. In this article, he says there's nothing more lushly sentimental or feebly satanic than modern detective fiction could be imagined. I mean, that's an interesting thing to say for a guy that supposedly devoured them.
Yes, and he might have started devouring them in the 60s, though. Maybe they got better. You know, he's talking about jazz. Don Field talks about Marshall putting down black music, Negro music back then, saying that was pretty unhip in the beatnik era. He still had Duke Ellington, these people coming to visit McLuhan.
Yeah.
I don't think you could say that McLuhan had a particular preference either way. It depended on who he's addressing it. I mean, jazz is taking over in the 40s. He's going to be a contrarian. It doesn't mean he will stay in that position later.
Yeah, fair enough.
I think, we don't know if he read detective fiction on life. Let's assume he did. It's good you point out that quote because his chemical body did not follow what his writings were saying. He's not the... he read more books than anybody. And here's this guy who's got this image of saying books are obsolete.
Yeah, as the first post that we talked to, McLuhan reads books.
Yeah. So I think he was... that was part of his manipulative satire. He didn't mind these misconceptions floating around. He may have got tired of it by the 70s, though. I was talking with... Dark Matter. He's wondering about why McLuhan sounded de-energized in the 70s. He seemed to have a bit of the wind taken out of him. Didn't have that get up and go of the 60s voice. Didn't know whether it was the illness, fatigue with what he's doing, or age. Aging.
Yeah, or whether that was the pitch that he adopted for the time. I guess that one's up for debate.
Yeah. It's a good point. He was being Methuselah. He'd been around for 10,000 years, 200 years every 12 months. So that could have been part of the image. Then again, we may be completely wrong, and the guy was a basket case.
That'd be insane.
That's the Ivor Winter School. The Ivor Winter School of Mediacology. Or maybe it's Ivor. It's Y-V-O-R, Ivor. Ivor, right? Ivor Winter.
Yep.
So there's not much more to say on this one, is there?
No. Let's keep going and see whether we can get up to date. The next one's May 20.
Okay. The medium is the message. Written on May 20th. So you read this one.
Okay. The medium is the message. I understand that there is some speculation and little evidence for where Marshall McLuhan first used this phrase. This will perhaps put that to rest. Here, in Marshall's own handwritten words, is the provenance, if not of when he came up with his best-known aphorism, at least of when he first spoke it in public. The note is written alongside the title on page 350 from Source to Statement by James M. McCrimmon, and that's in 1968, where The Medium is a Message, Chapter 1 of Understanding Media, is reprinted. First use of the phrase in June, and there's a question mark, 1958, at Radio Broadcasters Conference in Vancouver, was reassuring them that TV could not end radio. And so the infamous Heritage Minute ad, which shows an inspired Marshall McLuhan saying, "The medium is the message," as if for the first time in 1961, has it wrong. There are many other notes in the book, but that one is the most striking, at least to me. Thanks for reading, Andrew.
Yeah, now, we could blame maybe Bob Logan. I understood he had a consulting role with the Heritage Minute. I've seen that mid-90s McLuhan plug, McLuhan historical moment. Logan should have known better. He should have told him it was 57. You know, I'm pretty sure I've seen it said, this note we get here by Marshall, I've seen it done many times in the archives, and in my mind he was saying 57. So we need to get the old actual books. No, Mark Stewart wasn't there in 57. Whatever records they have of Marshall's diary, check that. It might be June 57. But it is true that he was there to reassure him that TV could not end radio. He repeats that several times. You've seen these remarks a couple times, right? When
yeah.
you went through.
Yeah.
Do you remember it being 57?
No, I was, my state numerical. Of mind when I was through there was like, who cares? It's
right.
Yeah, probably had I been more diligent and going back now, I would pay attention to these little details. But it didn't strike me as relevant at the time.
Yeah, now this is the you can look at the books, The Medium is a Message, and the books of 68, 69, 70, Cliched Archetype, is Marshall meta, being meta about himself. Okay, now he's an image, he's an icon, now he's going to comment on the effects of that. So it's interesting, here he is, he's arrived, his essay, The Medium is a Message, is famous, it's in this 1968 book, and so he starts talking about himself. He's looking at the person and how he said it and when he said it. You know what I mean? There's a self-consciousness here. And it's in the late 60s when he went meta about himself. So he consciously was thinking about himself as a historical artifact in 68, and that's why he notated in this book, which was, a retrospective collection. And look what the title is. From Source to Statement. See, the very words are about, when did you make the statement? What is the source of your statement?
Yeah.
You know, it fits the title of the book.
Yeah, completely. I've often wondered about that that McLuhan folding on himself. And then I was reading recently Media and the Changing Concepts of Spatial Form. And there's a great line in that. Where, for the artists in various fields are always engaged in making pilot models of coming modes of experience. The artist is acutely aware of any change in the bias amongst our senses. He at once provides a new image of experience in terms of this altered ratio. He acts as a kind of psychic and social navigator, providing new strategies of culture to cope with the new challenges and the patterns of experience. And so here we've got McLuhan, you know, reflecting back upon himself. And in a sense, he did provide a pilot model of how you cope and deal with that.
Right, and when was that? When was that article?
Media and the Changing Concepts of Spatial Form. I'll just get a date. 1 second.
He had said that statement before the late
1960.
1960. Yeah, he had said that statement before the late '60s, and that's an example.
Yeah, I just quite like that. The inclusion of the pilot model. I found that really nice to.
Yeah, and you think of the air traffic control metaphor he used. The thing about when he talked about the artist, and a couple of clever commentators have noted this, he talked about only the artist knows what's going on, and everybody would run to art. But what Marshall meant was himself. He was the only artist or scientist worthy of any environmental pitch. You see, when he describes the artist, he's describing what he's doing.
Yeah.
You know, it's exactly what he's doing, what his motive is. And so people mistook the artist, the actual arts that were becoming popularized and commodified in the 60s, 70s, in the era of the baby boomers, becoming part of social communion, cultures are business. That's not the artist he means. And he has in Cultures or Business, one of the ads shows he calls it Aesthete Model 1968. It shows some guy, he's a truck driver, he's a this, he's a that, and he likes Picasso, you know, he's the new, quote, feminized man, interested in software. He's definitely not a Latin. He's not from South America. He's probably a WASP. And do you know that image? Do you remember that in Cultures Are Business?
No. But it's I was just getting flashbacks of we're 2 weeks ago we were discussing the South African who's just the absolute antithesis of that figure.
Right, and you mean South American or no, South African?
The South African guy. What was his name?
Was he a friend of McLuhan?
Yeah, who we were discussing him in, I think, Mum Number 6, who came to visit him.
Yeah, it's funny, I can't think of it. Oh, Roy Campbell.
Yeah, Roy Campbell.
Yeah, right. But what's happened is aestheticism has taken over. Men were forced, since the women had mobility now, they're forced to mingle in non-traditional male zones like art galleries and cultural events and go to book launches. This is all normal fare in big cities now. But Marshall's picking it off in the late 60s. He calls it Aesthete Model 1968. And so that is not the artist that Marshall's talking about. You know, he was looking at the arts to show signs of what everybody was hypnotized by. The artists were very good at outlining the characteristics of the larger medium. Or the larger new technology, which was affecting the old medium. We got into this. I don't know if you heard this part of Mom. The medium is a message. The medium refers to new technology, but also old technology. So it's a flipping back and forth.
Two mediums.
Yes, two mediums.
Maybe it should have been the mediums are the message.
Yeah. Okay, so... I think I don't see any more to discuss here. Well, there's the book, From Source to Statement. Okay, do you have anything else to say?
No, it's I find the quibbling about, like, who said some little phrase, you know, when first, it doesn't really resonate with me very deeply.
Yeah, but Andrew's right to point out that it was a lot earlier.
Yeah, totally.
A lot earlier than people thought. He first says the medium is the message, I think, that sentence in the mid-50s in a Renaissance review. I'd have to check my archives, but actually writes that out. It might have been 59, 661, but it's striking. He says the phrase in the 50s, it seems to me. I don't know if he says it in Explorations. So, he may have written it before he uttered it. Anyway, he certainly knew the meaning was a message by 53 when he analyzed Finney's Wake. That's the point.
Okay, so let's move on to the next one, which is a reviews, renewed, and caveat utilitor.
Caveat utilitor. One thing, I often think about, say, anybody, a Joyce or somebody, reading in 53, that Finney's Wake treated media as art forms. Do you realize that that would be just incomprehensible? I don't think anybody in the world would know what that meant. But Marshall knew what he meant, and that's how invisible environment he was. I mean, you know that nobody knew. They think you can't even understand Finney's Wake, or it's not even worth reading. And to say that it showed the media art forms, that's an incredible statement. So early, 1953.
How much of do you think McLuhan's understanding of Joyce was influenced by his conversations with Lewis and Pound?
None. Though I think Lewis's writing helped him see that aspect of Finnegan's Wake. You know, Lewis's writing, I don't know what they talked about. I thought that maybe Lewis told McLuhan. I picked up that McLuhan learned more about the power struggles, the quote conspiracies within the Bloomsbury Group or whoever was running London, the art world, or the New York art world. I think Lewis would talk more on that level. Who were the latest Freemasons of the art world? I think that's what Marshall got the inside on. Remember, the title of the Wyndham Lewis character in Self-Condemned, he's a historian who writes a secret history of World War II.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that seems to indicate the kind of conversations that Rene Harding has with John McKenzie. I think that's what McLuhan's name in the book is, John McKenzie. It's more indicative of the top-down kind of talk.
Yeah, I just can't help but think, though, that McLuhan would have actually said, so what do you think about Joyce? It would have been the
obvious. Well, that's in the Self-Condemned. The McLuhan character says that the new fad for Superman stuff. He says, we have Joyce doing Superman language. You have Lewis, the writer, putting Lewis kind of statements in the mouth of Marshall McLuhan, which is interesting. He might be making fun of the fact that McLuhan, the McKenzie character, McLuhan character, was parroting Lewis.
Yeah,
I'd have to go back and read the novel carefully. I haven't done it in 40 years, a long time.
I think I've got a topic, or at least a few questions for the second 3 hours of the next Monday is what McLuhan and Kenner asked Pound, and what were the conversations between McLuhan and Lewis.
Well, who are you going to ask about this?
The figure that occasionally turns up on the second half of...
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. What do I call him? You know who?
Yeah.
You know who. We got to be careful. Show up right here. what were we just saying? It's interesting. I actually, through the Evergreens, here's what the Evergreens told me that they first discussed in the summer of 43 when they met. And the Evergreens described them in the backyard or someplace. It could have been in St. Louis. Anyways, what they discussed was the pockets in the long coats that soldiers wore. So you had these long coats, a certain kind of coat with big pockets, and how the paperback book fit in that pocket. They were talking about the paperback book and I guess how books were adapting to the speeded up society of the 40s. I mean, you look at books in the 30s, there are these crummy hardcover things, right? Very not so colorful, the print covers of these things.
Yeah.
The paperback is a new innovation. So the shaping of the paperback, and I guess how that affected writing, in other words, a medium is a message kind of theme, is what the Evergreen said Lewis and McLuhan talked about. And it was a big insight or a revelation for McLuhan or something. You know, it was significant.
Yeah, he often, well, not often, but he often refers to pocketbooks. You know, and talking about occasionally reflecting on the form of the book itself.
Yeah, the paperback you write was called a pocketbook, and they were discussing the pockets in these coats and something about the paperback or the pocketbook. So that's all I have on that. It'd be interesting to know.
Unless it was code for talking Germans, you know, like I know it like the inside of my pocket.
I don't get the sense from the correspondence with Pound that they went into the conspiracy stuff that Pound was notorious for. I don't think McLuhan worked them that way. He worked on the bottom-up approaches.
Yeah.
Probably because, well, what would be the reason? He knows what they're interested in, so he can pick at what they really were interested in, what they really had discovered. I think he'd go for that. The medium is the message kind of information. Okay, so you originally asked me, what did he get?
Yeah, whether he got anything because we're talking about McLuhan's statement that Finnegan's Wake treats media as art forms, and how radical that statement would have been in the 50s, particularly early 50s. And I was wondering whether McLuhan got his insight to go in that direction from Lewis or Pound, possibly talking with him directly.
I'd say Lewis, from Lewis, because Lewis does talk about the medium in The Art of Being Ruled. That's the point, is that Lewis first to deal with media en bloc, in BLOC. That's, you see what Lewis was really about in Sheila Watson's PhD, which was guided by Marshall. The fact that the bailiff was the BBC. And you don't see that in any other criticism. And Paul Edwards, you know, the top Wyndham Lewis scholar, said if they had all read Sheila Watson's thesis in the 60s when McLuhan was trying to get published, Lewis scholarship would have been very advanced.
Radically different.
Yeah. They didn't know that McLuhan was doing Lewis at the time, if they read any McLuhan. And I talked to Paul Edwards and Al Munton. I think Al Munton, he was over in Ottawa. He was looking at McLuhan at the same time he was doing Lewis. So he knew they were connected. But I don't know if they really saw. You go back, you ever read The Art of Being Ruled?
Yeah, I've read it a couple of times. It's a hard read, but it's worth it.
But you see that Lewis is trying to, he's showing that there's some technological effect happening.
Yes, but Lewis takes a long time to say everything.
Yeah. Okay, so reading Reviews Renewed and Caveat Utilitor, May 26, 2011. In Scripto 26, what's that mean? Is this the 26th entry?
Possibly.
Yeah. Forgotten Reviews number 1. Shall I read it or you?
Yeah, well, it's, unless you like me reading it, Bob.
No, I don't like you. You're
you see, you've got to listen to my accent, and with my cold, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, your accent isn't, it's no justice to what is being said. And I'm used to you, and I'm straining. Just think of the wasp. How does the wasp handle this? Okay. Andrew writes, bringing you one of Marshall McLuhan's reviews this week, found in the subject volume. What's the subject volume? That book, Mass Media and National Development?
May refer to... McLuhan always had those folders that were like a subject files. Right.
Oh, yeah. Found the subject volume. I don't think it was ever published. This review is timely, as in news recently. this. I found they're trying to have internet. Okay, this review is timely, as in news, recent news. I found there, they are trying to have, there is in quotes, I found they're trying to have internet access deemed a basic human right. He says, to editorialize briefly, that's him commenting, right? Usually rights are accompanied by responsibilities. In this case, I would suggest that the people pushing for universal access to the internet ought to let people know something of the, in brackets, unalterable effects, the unalterable and inevitable, question mark, effects of the medium they wish so righteously to give access to. Andrew's becoming McLuhanite, right?
It would appear.
Eric recently suggested to me, in brackets, we were talking about recent scientific studies about the changing brain and how use of new media affects brain development. Eric recently suggested to me that media should come with warnings as to their effects, like cigarettes or airbags. An example, caution, this medium's effects have not been completely considered prior to release. Unquote. And so that's what Eric was saying to him. And then Andrew says, yeah, that'll happen. When hell freezes over, I guess, is the tone there, right?
Yep.
Yeah, that'll happen. Yeah, humans are never going to look at themselves as sinful characters. Right? Sin will not be investigated.
Yeah, well, unless he's going, yeah, well, the technological artifact's disappearing. You can't have a warning on it.
Yeah, the artifacts are disappearing. That's what you're saying right now?
Yeah.
It's very good.
All the significant artifacts just they don't exist.
Yeah, that's a good point.
In any physical form.
The last warning would have been put on Netscape in 1995. Then it was over. That's the last one. So Eric is talking about media effects. There aren't any anymore. There are no medium like that that you could tag. Very good point. Hey, you're learning, Andrew. Thank you. You're taking it in. Yeah, that's right. And here's a book called Mass Media and National Development, The Role of Information in the Developing Countries. Wilbur Schramm, Stanford University Press, 750. Wilbur Schramm is one of the guys that Marshall makes fun of in Understanding Media, right? He's one of those established information studies people in the 50s Marshall doesn't think is not impressed with. So here we go. In the review of Mass Media and National Development, The Role of Information in the Developing Countries, Professor Schramm's foreword indicates his study to be, quote, part of the continuing effort of the United Nations and UNESCO to help develop the mass media of communication. Now, is he going to lay out the transistors that the United Nations are depositing in the Middle East that's going to lead to chaos? Remember that thing he'd always mentioned about the Middle East?
Yeah.
Let's see if he brings that fact in. So, sorry, I slurred over this. I'm going to do it again. Professor Schramm's foreword indicates his study to be, quote, part of the continuing effort of the United Nations and UNESCO to help develop the mass media of communication, unquote. McLuhan writes, it was reported to the General Assembly of the United Nations in 1972 that, quote, 70% of the population of the world lack inadequate information facilities and are thus denied effective enjoyment of the right to information, unquote. McLuhan says, that statement is a far cry from the 19th century insistence on the human right to self-expression. So basic was the concept of self-expression that John Ruskin could greet the opening of cable service to India with the derisive query, quote, what have we to say to India, unquote. Today it is assumed that the human right to media facilities is on the same plane as the right to nourishment. Then he quotes the book. If UNESCO's minimum standards were achieved, it would mean that approximately one out of every two families would have a daily newspaper and one out of every four families a radio receiver. There would be one television set and one cinema seat for every 10 families. Not too much to ask, unquote. So McLuhan says, to a large extent, Professor Schramm's survey is an inventory of the media resources of the undeveloped countries of the world. Where such resources are lacking, Professor Schramm cautiously hints that old-fashioned cultural patterns still persist. Then he says, quote, page 77 is marked. Then McLuhan continues, it might be thought that in the absence of adequate mass communication, the more traditional means of communication would take over the bridge, would take over the, I think that's mis- printed. It might be thought that in the absence of adequate mass communication, the more traditional means of communication would bridge the urban-rural information gap. And so far as possible, this does happen. Meetings are held by government officials and political spokesmen. Folk plays, puppets, singers are as popular as ever. Bazaars and markets still provide excuse for exchange of information, along with exchange of money or goods. The communication grapevine in quotes, still flourishes. But most of these are slow or... Oh, wait a minute. He's quoting from... This is all a quote from the book. I'm going to reread it. See, it ends with a quotation mark.
Yeah.
I thought McLuhan was saying that. But definitely the end is Schramm. But most of these are slow or limited channels. So rereading it, this is what Schramm's writing. It might be... McLuhan doesn't say much in his review then. What is Marshall saying? He doesn't say... No. This is mixed up here.
Okay, so it's just at this end, this last little two paragraphs. It's difficult to determine who's saying what.
But here's what McLuhan writes. He provides a most useful bibliography of the existing studies and reports on media in undeveloped areas.
Yeah.
That's all he writes. And then he talks about, above it, he says it's an inventory of the media resources. Same sentence. Okay, so where such resources are lacking, Professor Schramm cautiously hints that old-fashioned cultural patterns still persist. That was the whole section I read. So, boy, it's a real skimpy review, isn't it? The only point is Marshall saying that the right to self-expression is 19th century. So what's he mean by, is that the same right to media facilities, or is that the right to self-consumption? Not sure. He's not, what's he saying here? His self-expression is something the opposite. But now we have human right to media facilities that would only give us self-expression?
I think you've... It's like an incomplete review, Bob.
Yeah.
And so he's saying, well, this statement's a far cry from this. Okay, so we're pointing out a different situation, contrasting the 19th century of Ruskin with the United Nations, and I guess Andrew in his editorials, talking about the United Nations in present day. And then we've got a review here again. To a large extent, Professor Schramm's survey is an inventory of media resources. So he's going, great, well, Mr. Schramm's done a pretty bad job, but he's given us a nice bibliography and a nice sort of survey of the world. And then this last paragraph here is confusing.
Okay, So basically, Mr. Schramm has failed, has no clue to the causes of cultural change.
Yeah, but we can still use his book because he provides us with a good bibliography of what's going on. So
yeah, a bunch of facts that he can reuse properly. Reuse the facts properly.
So Schramm's assumptions are wrong, but there's still data in that. And presumably right, so, some value in the fact that people take Schramm seriously.
Okay, I want to figure out what the 19th century insists on the human right to self-expression. And that's the 19th century. The 20th century would be the century of non-self-expression, or people having the right to media that you would think of them self-expression, but maybe it's having rights, big media environments that makes the people passive. See, it's interesting. It's important to figure out what does he consider the media of the 20th century? They're not agencies of self-expression? Because McLuhan's, one of his first sentences in his first essay in the first issue of Explorations is about the natural human desire to express itself and have other people agree with them.
Yeah, yeah. The implications of cultural uniformity, I think it is.
Well, that's a statement of an article in the 70s. That's not the title of the... It's Culture Without Literacy. It's the first essay in the first explorations. But it's, McLuhan pointed out about self-expression as a Gutenberg concept. He would make fun of that. in the 20th century. It was teamwork and impersonal expression, not self-expression. So somehow getting the right to have nourishment by access to new media facilities is not the world of self-expression. I guess that's what McLuhan's saying. Right? Gutenberg, self-expression. So back to... So he quotes Schramm pointing out how everybody should have a right to this number of TV sets and that number of radio receivers. And now here is Schramm talking about how old-fashioned cultural patterns still persist. Quote, Schramm says, it might be thought that in the absence of adequate mass communication, the more traditional means of communication would take over the bridge and bridge the urban-rural information gap. And so far as possible, this does happen. Meetings are held by government officials and political spokesmen. Folk plays, puppets, singers are as popular as ever. Bazaars and markets still provide excuse for exchange of information with exchange of money or goods. The communication grapevine still flourishes, but most of these are slow or limited channels. Unquote. Then Marshall says, he provides the most useful bibliography of the existing studies and reports of media and underdeveloped. End of review. Very skimpy review. Not worth reviewing, I guess. So what does it say? Reviews renewed and caveat utilitor. Does that mean using something, beware? The user of a new media environment, beware. The African should be aware of getting radio and transistor because they'll turn into civil wars all over the continent. Schramm misses that point. So reviews renewed, you mean just the fact that he's presenting the review for us to consider. He's renewing it. Making it available, right?
Yep.
Okay, anything else you want to say about this?
No, nothing much on that one, actually.
Okay, the next one, Professor Fieldhouse's Revolution. Is this the last one?
We could be getting there. One second, I'll just go and check.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, we're going to be up to date. Yeah, this is the last one.
We're going to finish. Okay. Oh, there's an big comment from Mark Stallman. Oh, then there's another comment by Stallman. A little bit of dialogue between Andrew and Mark. Okay, let's see where this leads us. It's called Professor Fieldhouse's Revolution, May 31st, 2011. Dear readers, says Andrew. In the back of the, quote, a book by Thomas Carlyle, 1925, Every Man Edition. The book is The French Revolution, A History, Volume 1. So in the back of this book, there is a handwritten biographical note, January 20th, 1932. So I think Marshall's talking about a professor in Winnipeg, right? Professor Fieldhouse.
Yeah, I think... Fieldhouse was the supervisor for his
masters.
Yeah, I think it might be because I remember Cameron McEwen making a lot of Fieldhouse.
Okay, so Marshall notes: I have today heard Professor Fieldhouse on the subject of the revolution, and his remarks in brackets to be found in no existing text. And his remarks seem to me to be worth noting down. First, the French were not an oppressed people. The peacents were not mercilessly ground under the heels of the aristocrats. They had, in 1789, bought from one half to two-thirds of the land, and having tasted the possibilities that power offered, they were in a mood for more. Moreover, a truly oppressed and miserable nation never is dangerous in revolt. Louis XVI was no despot, but a well-intentioned reformer surrounded by men of disinterested motives and tidy minds, men who would have found themselves in complete accord with a group of Fabians, that'd be the British socialists, men suited to make statistical inquiries and to sit on tedious committees. What the heck is all that noise, Andrew?
Just grabbing a piece of chewing gum.
Okay, and to sit... Men suited to make statistical inquiries and to sit on tedious committees. There's that dislike of committees again. We have that in the 70s from McLuhan. He reminding these student revolutionaries they'll just end up on committees. if they're successful.